Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linardutti, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, as ever, our arts editor, is with us here. Lucy, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right. I got my words in the wrong order there because I'm just very excited. Last week we had David in Johannesburg's delicate flute rendition, and this week the writer Thomas Morris, usually to be found exploring the history of medicine, has brought his cello to the challenge. I feel the ante being up.
It is terrific, isn't it? Because
it's something else.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. And to say, has anyone else got one? Hey presto, we've got a brilliant one.
No, and if anyone else is bold and talented enough to refresh our theme tune, please do. I suspect no other podcast has launched such an appeal, and we may yet find out why.
I'm still just to say, I'm still holding out for the theremin or the swanee or slide whistle. Just putting it out there.
But the swanee and the slide is the same.
It is. I hadn't realised that. Yeah, it's the same thing.
Okay, well, that is the challenge. Email me or find the TLS on Twitter and at it. Coming up on this week's show, who could fail to be pulled in by an article that begins, Keats and Mrs. Jones had a thing going on. They had a feeling that it was wrong, so they kept very quiet about it. Her identity has always remained a puzzle, leading some biographers to frustration and others to outlandish speculation. Jonathan Bate will share some theories about this Mrs. Jones. And we'll canter through this week's pages, covering everything from Dante in the 21st century to Wagner's debt to Iceland. But first, Lucy, over to you.
It took centuries to work out the social and political implications of movable type. Why would anyone think we'll be able to crack the internet by next Tuesday? This is the question put by Alan Rusbridger, the former editor of The Guardian and now principal of Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford, and chair of the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. He's writing about Bellingcat, the investigative body which has revealed facts and details about events happening all across the world, from the Arab Spring to the poisoning of Alexei Navalny. As the founder of Bellingcat, Elliot Higgins has just published a book on its origins and methods. And we're delighted that Alan Rusbridger is here today to talk to us about it. Alan, many thanks for joining us.
Hiya.
First of all, could you explain how Elliot Higgins started and set up Bellingcat?
Yeah, Elliot Higgins was the archetypal nerd in his spare bedroom. I mean, almost literally, he'd been working he was a Leicester office worker in his early 30s, and either became fed up with his job or lost his job, but. Found himself increasingly whiling away his time talking to his computer in his bedroom and discovered that he was rather good at seeking out information that either nobody else was interested in or knew how to access.
And so do you think he was one of the people, I know the internet had been around for a while by then, but do you think he was one of the people who grasped the possibilities, what was happening and how you could use it quite early on?
I think so. I mean, you know, within newspapers at the time, and The Guardian, I think, was, you know, as advanced as anybody. You were working with a newsroom of you know, highly experienced journalists who had spent their life using different kind of techniques, including on the ground reporting. It was a long time in many newspaper offices before you had computers that were connected to the outside world. For a long time, we had giant ATEX machines that spoke to each other, but didn't access the internet. And so traditional journalists, I think, were caught on the hop, I think, by this generation of geeks who were very early into the internet and were slow to realize the possibilities that lay there for reporting.
And what were the first sorts of things that Elliot Higgins, what did he start to look into, and how did he set about it? What tools did he use?
Well, as far as I know, and the book names lots of open source tools, lots of which I've never used and had never heard of. But I suppose in those early days, he would have started with Google and then Google Maps and then Google Earth and tools that were, you know, reasonably common. And he discovered, he was very interested in the Arab Spring, you know, obsessively interested and was following it. And he discovered, again, which I think a lot of mainstream journalists were too proud, if you like, to notice, that this was a revolution that was being live streamed, that there were thousands, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people in those Middle Eastern and North African countries who were recording and broadcasting and documenting what was going on. And he rather enthusiastically started hanging out on chat boards and comment sections, including The Guardians. And he became rather interested in weaponry and who was using what arms and how you could detect what weaponry had been used from shrapnel and stuff like that.
And do you think it's partly because you quote him as quoting this extraordinary observation, which is made by Michael Flynn, the former director of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency? The quote is that the secret sources used to contribute 90% of valuable intelligence. And then he says, after the arrival of social media, it was the opposite. 90% of worthy intelligence came from open sources available to all.
Yeah, again, that was a very striking thing to me. I suppose it's kind of obvious if you think about it. So if you think how reporting used to be done, you know, you would send your correspondent off to the Middle East, and most papers could afford to have one person in the Middle East, but perhaps two. Then suddenly you've got these simultaneous revolutions in five, six, seven countries. It was beyond the resources of any newspaper, really, to have the human intelligence to monitor all that on the ground. And it coincided precisely with the time where social media was being born. And so suddenly you had thousands of voices, and what it needed was people to pick out the interesting voices from the nutty voices or the hate-filled voices or the agitators and try and work out the signals that would be reliable. And I'm not surprised on reflection that ended up being a ratio of 90% to 10%.
Yeah, it's just when you hear about it that way that it's turned intelligence gathering, as it were, on its head. You say it needs a very particular kind of, as you say, you have to join all the chat rooms. It's not a question of one search, is it? You have to go very deep into the photographs and the chat rooms and the threads and everything. You say it's for a particular kind of sort of researcher, if you like.
Yes, I think it suits a certain kind of brain and sensibility. I couldn't do it. I couldn't begin to do it. But you know, people whose brains are wired in that way and who have got the curiosity and the patience and the know-how and the sort of obsessive interest to follow tiny clues down the ultimate rabbit warren. Those are the people who combined, because the other point was that these were, although these were lone individuals in, as it were, their bedrooms, they were combining with each other through social media and saying, look, you know, I'll look here if you look there, and can anybody identify this and help me out here, give me some help on this particular angle. So it was like a sort of squad of private investigators collaborating in the open on platforms like Twitter to solve nutty problems.
Yes, and it's the not only the collectiveness, but the in the open. Do you think that comes in part from a tech philosophy? Because there's a very strong strand of tech, isn't there, that's keen on open source and shared information, anti-monopoly, that kind of thing. Do you think that the philosophy comes from there?
Absolutely. And, you know, that was the great battle 10, 15 years ago, and maybe still is, this battle between open and closed. And most of the engineers that I worked with at The Guardian were on the side of open. They thought there was a new kind of utopian way of running the world in which everything would be open sourced and the product of collaboration and joint creativity. And I have to say that Bellingcat is one of the most outstanding examples that sort of reinforces that idea of how things could be done.
Yeah, because they sort of made a leap sideways from it not being engineering and tech into let's apply this somewhere else.
Yeah, and I mean, it was happening a bit in journalism. I mean, some of the most interesting journalists I worked with realized that instead of working as reporters traditionally did, which was, you know, I'm onto this story, I don't want anybody else to know I'm on this story because I want it to be my story, started going out and saying openly, I'm working on this story, please help me. I mean, we had a journalist called Paul Lewis who did that when the G20 met in London in, I'm guessing this was about right about 2010. And do you remember there was a news seller who died in the heart of a crowd outside the G20?
Yes.
And Paul just openly tweeted saying, I don't necessarily believe the official story. Were you there? Could you look on your cameras to see if you've got any evidence? And then he really did what Bellingcat did, and, you know, combined the maps, the time of day, the film, and eventually he came across a piece of video that showed that this guy had been hit from behind by a policeman. He hadn't died of a heart attack. He'd died because he hit his head on the ground. And so, you know, people watched that kind of reporting and thought, well, actually, maybe there's a kind of reporting that is better done in this open source way rather than privately.
And just to, I mean, just to give a sense of what all this has achieved, I mean, I wonder whether we could mention some of the Bellingcat's greatest hits, if you like, you know, some of the cases that have defined its arrival, because it sort of has come out of nowhere almost to now being something that most people will recognise and we hear about all the time.
Yeah, well, he began to concentrate on I mean, once he'd sort of, you know, got his long big trousers on and graduated from the chat boards and the Guardian Live blog, where he used to go in and offer his thoughts, and that they started, they had their own platform, and a team of people, of like-minded people, none of whom I think were being paid at the time. They then started concentrating on Syria, and Syria, we know, was becoming an impossible story for any conventional war reporter to report, particularly after the death of Mary Colvin. And so really the only way of reporting it was virtually. And they became literally world experts in weaponry. And when, for instance, you know, one side claimed that the other side had been guilty of a gas attack or some kind of atrocity, they would look at the social media around the weaponry and say, well, no, actually, we can definitively say it was this side, not that side. And so there were some famous breakthrough moments where they started beating not only the world's press, but I suspect many of the world's intelligence services.
And you say that they were, at the beginning, certainly they were, you think they were working, they were unpaid. How does the money work? How does the organisation of the money work now? Who funds it? And are they professional or amateur, the investigators?
Well, I think increasingly people became fascinated by how they kept turning up this material that no one else could. They got some money from academia for a while. I don't know if they still are. Higgins was attached to the war studies department at King's College London. And philanthropic institutes started giving the money to, and I think they've now got a turnover of about $1 million and something like 30, I was going to say journalists, contributors, investigators, whatever you want to call them. They don't really have a name. I think it's 30 contributors and 18 full-time employees. So it's grown into a proper professional operation.
That's interesting in itself, isn't it? The fact that we don't really know what to call them. We don't really know what to call Bellingcat. I mean, is it fair, do you think, to feel some sort of unease about that side of it? If, you know, for an organization that is about accountability and all of that sort of thing, is there a scenario in which we need to be able to say what Bellingcat is and all of that sort of thing?
Yes. I mean, you know, my instinct with all information these days is to be skeptical, including about mainstream information. You know, I think there's never been more misinformation and disinformation swirling around us all the time. So I think it's right to be skeptical about them. Their answer to that, I think, is, well, we open source everything. We don't expect you to believe us. That was the old school way. Old school journalists would say, look, you know, trust me because I work for the Daily Beast. And I've got my sources and you're going to have to believe my sources. What we do it is all open source. So you can follow our trail and you can choose to believe it or not, but it'll be based on evidence.
And when you're talking about the disinformation and everything swirling around, because you say that Higgins says, Bellingcat will act as a firewall against disinformation. And that has been put to the test, hasn't it, under Donald Trump's presidency and to some extent the pandemic by what he calls the counterfactual community, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, there are so many layers to this of people who are deliberately out there creating bad content and lies. And then there are people who are followers of conspiracy theories or people who live in echo chambers and people who are ideologically attached to one pole or other of the political spectrum. So there are all kinds of players, and there are, of course, billions of them. And we don't fully understand the role of the networks and the platforms in amplifying some voices and not others. So it is chaos out there at the moment.
And partly because, I mean, he says the sometimes there are stated aims. People now, they kind of, I guess people are now a bit aware of what Bellingcat are doing. So they're putting stuff out to sort of flood, to put noise out there, if you like, to try and hide some other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they're much more high profile now, and there are lots of conspiracy theories that have been circulating or deliberately circulated about them. I mean, they've done very well on Russia, for instance, and they were first onto demonstrating who shot down the Malaysian Airlines flight, and they followed up with a spectacular scoop identifying the two agents who visited allegedly Salisbury Cathedral before attempting to murder Sergei Skripal. So the Russians are not their friends, and the Russians we know are prime agents in spreading disinformation and saying, look, these guys are not genuine, they're British intelligence.
And given that they are now, everybody kind of knows about them and they've had these great big stories, do you think finally that, is there any sense that it is reaching its limits? Has that alerted people to start covering their tracks, or do you think there are just too many potential sources? Is it too late to put the cat back in the bag, do you think?
I mean my sense is when they describe how they work, I mean, it's some of it to a, you know, I mean, I'm not a technophobe, I'm a technophile, but I'm that's, you know, I'm a long way from being expert. And somehow, sometimes when they describe their techniques, so that, you know, there is, you know, just a field where somebody has been beheaded or whatever, and they have to work out where that field is, and they look at the sort of the angle of the sun, and then they start working out where, you know, where the shadows are falling, and that there's an anonymous building on the skyline. They did it rather amazingly with, there were some pictures after cruise liners stopped going into Venice. Somebody posted a picture on Twitter saying, look, there are fresh fish in the lagoons and the canals of Venice. And they had almost nothing to go on, and yet they managed to identify exactly where this bridge was and where the picture had been taken. And I think, and we know now that it's so difficult to cover our digital tracks, that the digital clues out there are so prolific that it's not going to be easy to put this particular Bellingcat back into the bag, or whatever the awful pun is.
I was reaching somehow for the awful pun for the night. Yeah. It wasn't quite there. Yes, I see what you mean. So that it's everybody knows what they're up to, but equally everybody knows what everybody's up to in a way, because everything is so traceable.
Yeah, occasionally you read those pieces in newspapers where a journalist says, "No, I'm going to live for a week without leaving any digital clue at all," and usually by Wednesday they've given up. It's just impossible. So I fear we are doomed to leaving digital trails behind us, and as long as we do that, there will be people like Elliot Higgins following down those clues.
Yeah, okay, well, thank you very much for putting the clues together, and I'm sorry about the cat and the bag pun again. Many thanks for talking to us today.
Okay,
thank you, bye-bye.
Nice to talk. Okay, yes. Bye-bye.
Still to come on the show, desperately seeking Mrs. Jones, Dante on the radio, Wagner's debt to the Icelandic sagas, and something surprising. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, a gentle reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast for free via Apple Podcasts or pretty much any other podcast provider, and you'll never miss an episode.
Watching the end of One Night in Miami, I was reminded of the end of a play called Abe Lincoln in Illinois by Robert E. Sherwood, which ends with Lincoln having won the 1860 presidential election and heading off to Washington. And people are in tears at the end of that story because they know what's coming. You know, what's coming is civil war and Lincoln's assassination.
I think those labels, they all really annoy me. Actually, I find them fantastically unhelpful because they're either used to punch up or punch down. And really, it just means that a lot of people enjoyed reading the book. Well, then Hilary Mantel is middle brow, and so is Shakespeare, and so is Ulysses. A lot of people have enjoyed Ulysses. Actually, that you probably can't make that case. I'm making a risk at that point.
One of the things I've noticed since the book's been knocking about on social media, in terms of like me putting out pictures of the cover and talking about it, is a few people have said, I don't know whether or not I'm interested, but I don't know if I'd be happy reading that in public. It's kind of a provocative title, yes, but I think that's primarily about my sort of unvarnished use of the word Jew rather than Jewish person, although it's interesting how naff it would sound to say Jewish people don't count as a title, but Jews don't count, have much more power, and part of that power is to do with the negativity and the negative energy that I think surrounds the word.
There is a very sort of strong version that you often hear that classics is always legitimates the conservative. You know, Prince Charles, conservative architecture, classical architecture, right? Well, what about the ways that classics has sanctioned deviance? Can I have
I'm thinking of D.H. Lawrence immediately.
That might, I think.
I'm thinking about Catullus.
All these would be very good starts to your essays.
Can I do my essay on number 10, please? Can I just say that actually on Mary's blog, all 10 questions are there. So if people want to look at all 10 questions, that's where they are. People are allowed to choose their own, though Professor Pitt has chosen one for you.
Answers on a postcard, a really, really long one. So more of a scroll, really.
You have 1 hour only.
That's not enough.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Fiona Narduzzi, and before we go in pursuit of Keats's mysterious Mrs. Jones, Lucy, do you want to tell us what's going on in the rest of the issue? Last week on the show, you mentioned having ridden an Icelandic pony, and this week we're in Iceland again. Why is that?
Just because I like Iceland, Thea. Nothing, not related nothing to the more. TLS at all. No, that's not true. Because we're looking at the old Icelandic saga. I genuinely don't know how to pronounce it. Volsunga saga, I'm going to say.
Sounds good to me.
Thank you. Which is, I think, 13th century, our writer says, and it's the source of many of the human elements of the drama behind the Ring cycle. There's the Nibelung, which is the medieval German one, which is better known. And I think that our reviewer, Alan Davey, says that that's the source of the sort of supernatural stuff and with the gods. But for the more human and earthy elements, it's this old Icelandic saga. And he talks about that and what is done with it, what Wagner does with it in the Ring cycle.
Because if it had been more closely based on the medieval German epic, it probably would have been more kind of courtly and refined, less gritty.
He thinks that the earlier one, the Icelandic one, is pretty sort of a lot of them are, though, pretty dark and earthy. There's a lot of unpleasantness, frankly, let's be honest. There's a lot of bad behavior, but yes, it's not courtly, really, at all. It's just much more sort of primal than that, I suppose. And he's saying that a lot, he puts a lot of that into the Ring.
And elsewhere on the radio is Dante. So, I mean, you're kind of giving us all the perfect excuses to rest our screen-wearied eyes.
Well, yes, and there's a lot of wonderful stuff going on. And this is a radio programme sort of asking and explaining why is Dante still important in the 21st century kind of thing. And it's presented by the BBC's Europe editor, Katja Adler. And the readings from the comedy are by Michael Sheen. So it's all, you know, wonderful, high quality. And it's just, I think it's saying what it has meant to her and why it's still relevant. I think our reviewer, Muriel Zaga, felt that they kept saying, well, it might seem very old and dusty and religious, but, you know, really it's terribly important, but which she felt they didn't need to say that.
Well, I mean, I think that's a general rule, and I suppose a general temptation, isn't it, with these things? I'm always a bit wary of things that beat us around the head with the fact that something really, really old is in fact really, really modern. But I suppose in the case of Dante, it's sort of okay because he spoke himself of having urgent things to say to those who would call his own times ancient. So you can sort of let them off the hook there a little bit.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And she says, which you would know this, saying that for Italians now, he's like a living presence. It's not like, you know, it's not like a dusty, he's kind of everywhere.
Well, there's this brilliant thing, the Repubblica, which is one of the main newspapers in Italy. And in December last year, they mocked up the cover of the magazine in a kind of Time magazine style, you know, with the red border. And they had a picture of Dante and they said, and it said Man of the Year 2021. And because obviously this is 2021 is a massive year for Dante. It's 700 years since his death in 1321. So the presence is very much there. He's currency in Italy in the way that Shakespeare is currency here. In T.S. Eliot, you know, knew that himself, he said, didn't he say literature is split basically between two people, Shakespeare and Dante. Yes. There's no third.
Yeah, unless he was thinking secretly, or it might be me, but he didn't say that.
Exactly.
I've just
made
that up.
Please someone interrupt me and say it's me. I think that's what he was after.
And Muriel has a lovely thing. She says at the end of it, there's which I haven't heard, that the line of abandon hope, all ye who enter here, she says it should be seen for what it is. I think this is in the programme, they say. It should be seen for what it is. It's a rhetorical move on his part because, in fact, he thinks that we should never give up hope.
Exactly. And also because, of course, because you are reading on, you pass that threshold and you know that you haven't resolved within yourself that you have no hope. So, you know, the sort of the act of going on and reading it disproves the idea that there can be no hope, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. It makes lots of sense. Yeah, it's a lovely way of looking at it, I think.
That sort of ties in, actually, because we've got a lot more Dante in the paper this week. We've got, there's a nice long piece by Peter Hainsworth, and he's reviewing a recent book by the American academic John Tuke, and there's another one by Enrico Malato, who's one of Italy's leading Dante scholars. And one of the most interesting ideas that Peter Hainsworth points to is this theory of Tuke's of the work of the Commedia as being an invitation to readers to participate in the generation of meaning. So he says the imagery is a way of getting beyond abstract statements, so religious or philosophical or political, and to, he says, involve the reader in the creation of meaning with, you know, and there's loads of interpretive freedom involved in that, because even in the 14th century, the work needed decoding. You know, he emphasizes that it's not new, this thing of needing to find our way into it and try to work out what it means. And Peter Hainsworth points out, he says, the boundaries between the literal and the metaphorical, the historical and the fantastic, the personal and the symbolic are constantly shifting. And the references, the names, the ideas, all of those things would have been almost as unfamiliar to 14th century readers as they are to us today. So this would seem to explain why it is, you know, to sort of go back and further prove Katja Adler's point in her BBC series, you know, it would seem to explain why it is that this text does keep on giving, does remain relevant without trying almost, and does lend itself so well to video games and comic books and the visual arts and so many other forms.
But yeah, because you're also doing the work and you're also making the journey.
Exactly. One exists sort of, it's there's something very modern about that theory of decentering the author in that way, I think. The work almost doesn't exist, he's saying, without you entering and inhabiting the space of it.
And so then, in fact, he becomes Virgil and you become Dante, sort of?
Something like that, yeah.
Not really?
Sort of. Something like that. anyway, what else have we got? There's a piece on the poetic relationship between the Italian writer Eugenio Montale and T.S. Eliot, who we've already mentioned, how they both drew, albeit very differently, on the work of, you guessed it, Dante, but maybe we should mention something else. Lucy, surprise us.
Well, I'll tell you what, the thing that I thought was very interesting, one of the many things I thought was very interesting this week, is because we're talking about European literature, and this is a book which we reviewed in German, but I think it actually came out in French as well. I don't know whether that was later. I'm a bit hazy about the dates, I'm afraid. By a writer called Anne Weber. And in German, it's called Annette and so I'll pronounce this wrongly, Ein Heldinnen-Epos, which is like a heroine's epic. And it's about a real woman who is called Annette Beaumanoir, or maybe Anne Beaumanoir, who was in the resistance, then became a neurophysiologist, and then went to work for the Algerian National Liberation Front because she was horrified at the way her government was treating Algeria, then put on trial and sent her to prison, then escaped, went to Switzerland, then went back to France. So it's a sort of remarkable story, and it sounds like a remarkable work because it's written, I think, as a sort of epic poem, and it's constantly questioning motives. And if somebody behaves badly, sometimes she says, well, maybe somebody else would have done the same thing in their place. You know, maybe this is understandable. And And there's a lot of ways of looking at the subject. And she's a very interesting writer because she writes in French and German sort of all the time. She translates between the two. And as I say, I think she's her French version has come out as well.
And that she has such a tight grip on both of the languages suggests that there's plenty of scope for wordplay, which I'm a total sucker for.
Yes, yeah. And it actually would be if you had the time and the language skills, which I certainly do not, be really interesting to put the two of them next to each other, I think.
I mean, I'd like to think that I could read the French one, but I probably can't. So I might have to, I'm rather rusty, so I suspect I'll have to wait for someone to take up the challenge and translate it into English if that's not already underway. Perhaps someone will write in and let us know that it is. Reassure us that the work is being done.
Well, it won a prize. It won the Deutsche Buchpreis last year. So, you know, it clearly has got some favourable attention. So, yeah, let's hope.
Well, that bodes well. Now to John Keats, or rather to Mrs. Jones, a woman many have tried and failed to get to know. Jonathan Bate, the author most recently of Bright Star, Green Light, The Beautiful Works and Damned Lives of John Keats and F. Scott Fitzgerald, has taken up the chase this week and joins us on the line now to tell us more. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello there, Pia. Hi.
Now, this story begins with one of the most, as you say, marvellous passages in Keats's letters, which records an encounter that took place in October 1818 in London. Could you put the contents of the letter in a nutshell for us? It's not too small and plain a nutshell, you know. Do feel free to quote liberally, as you say, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is my favourite letter of John Keats. I mean, you know, the greatest letter writer among all the English poets. So he gives, his brother and sister-in-law are in America. So he writes them these long letters that are almost like journals. And he says, since I last wrote, I've seen again a woman, doesn't name her, who I met once before. In fact, he said, when I met her before, it was at Hastings, and I warmed with her and kissed her. And he describes how he bumps into this woman in the street and sort of walks past her, then turns back, and then they get into conversation and they walk together. And they walk to Islington to visit a friend of hers who keeps a school. And then they walk back into the area of London that is now Bloomsbury. And they go up to her rooms in Queen Square. And Keats gives this marvellous description of the room. There's caged birds, an Aeolian harp. You know, that's Coleridge wrote a famous poem about the Aeolian harp, a kind of fashionable musical instrument that if you put it on your windowsill, the wind would start making music out of it. And she had sheet music and books and a cabinet of liqueurs. She was obviously a woman of great style and sophistication. And then Keats sort of is on the brink of kissing her again. And she says, no, not this time. And sends him away, but gives him some game, presumably some grouse or partridge, to give to his brother, Tom, who was actually dying of tuberculosis at the time. And then later in the same journal letter, he says that she sent game to him again. But then she sort of disappears from the record.
And you're not the first to seek the identity of this kind of wonderful musical purveyor of game. what are you building on here? You know, what are some of the main theories about who this unnamed woman is?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, she wasn't really sort of noticed or talked about in Keats' biography until the 1950s, when the great biographer Robert Gittings wrote his life of Keats, in particularly focusing on this extraordinary year of creativity between the autumn of 1818 and the autumn of 1819, during which Keats wrote nearly all his greatest poems. And I think this is one reason why Mrs. Jones is so interesting, that the encounter is just at the beginning of that year. And indeed, it's worth saying that one of Keats's friends made a note that the idea for the poem, The Eve of St. Agnes, in some ways, I think the first of Keats's truly great poems, was given to him by Mrs. Jones. So Gittings started exploring, trying to see what he could find out about her. And he got information from the poet and biographer Edmund Blunden, London fine writer himself, of course, a First World War writer who had a subsequent career as a literary scholar and biographer. Blunden had written the biography of John Taylor, who was Keats's editor. Extraordinarily important man in the culture of the time, John Taylor, because he was the one who recognised Keats's talent, and indeed the talent of the great agricultural labourer poet John Clare. And Blunden discovered in the Taylor archive there were some letters from a Mrs. Isabella Jones to John Taylor, and it was clear that they were good friends. And it also mentions in one of her letters that she spent the summer in Hastings. So Gittings, on this basis, puts two and two together and sees that this woman, Isabella Jones, clearly is the Mrs. Jones of Keats's letters. And indeed, there's a rather beautiful letter she writes to Taylor, Keats's publisher, after Keats's death, because Taylor has shown her the letter written by another friend of Keats, the artist Joseph Seven, who was with him at his deathbed in Rome, his letter describing Keats's death. And Taylor has shown it to Mrs. Jones, and she's responded and talked about poor Keats. So there's no doubt that Isabella Jones, Mrs. Jones, as they keep calling her, no doubt that she is the woman. But who she was, how old she was, what her background was, what she was doing living alone in these rooms in Queen Square, nobody could quite work out. And Gittings, I think, followed one particular red herring that I've sort of tracked down, and it doesn't work. So I thought, in writing this new biography of Keats, you know, there's very few new facts to discover about him, but if I could find the identity of Mrs. Jones, that would really be something.
And so you find, as you do this, as you say, your aim being to sort of piece together who this woman was, not in terms of what her name was, but in terms of what kind of life she had. You find that much hinges, doesn't it, on this title, on the title Mrs.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because all previous biographers have tended to assume that she was a widow. And, you know, they've looked for, was there a Captain Jones of the army or somebody who had died and left her as a young widow? But again, they've all proved to be dead ends, those potential leads. But I was struck, looking closely at the Keats letter, he describes her as one of only two women of his own age whom he had ever met, who he felt that he could have a real sort of intellectual friendship with. The other one was his sister-in-law who went to America with his brother. A woman of my own age. Keats is in his early 20s at the time. Of course, she could have been a young widow. But then I thought, well, hang on. That title, Mrs., I've done a lot of work on the theatre in the early 19th century, and Mrs. was a title that was conferred on actresses and singers to give them respectability. The stage was still quite a disreputable profession at that time, especially for women. So Mrs. was a way of giving respectability. The most famous example, of course, would be the great comic actress Mrs. Jordan, who subsequently became the mistress of and bore, 10 children to the future King William. So I began searching stage records to see if there was a Mrs. Jones on the stage. And lo and behold, I found at exactly the period we're talking about, someone called Mrs. Jones came from the Provincial Theatre in Cheltenham, where she had considerable success as a singer and mild success as an actress. She came to London, she made her debut, but after a couple of performances, she disappears from the record. But it just struck me that that sense of the wit in her letters, her independent mindedness, the fact that there's all this music in her rooms, I thought perhaps she is Mrs. Jones, the singer and actress who briefly appeared on the London stage and then vanished. And so I then did some more research on actresses, singers, and private performances at the time. And one does discover that it was quite possible for a singer And it was her singing more than her acting that Mrs. Jones was celebrated for. A singer could make a living doing private performances at sort of soirees and evening parties. And indeed, one of the letters to Keats's publisher suggests that she held soirees herself.
She was clearly a very sort of cultured and arty woman, wasn't she? He has that wonderful, in the letter, he has that wonderful description of her room and her sitting room, and he says it's a very tasty sort of place. With the, as you say, it's got the Aeolian harp and it's got lots of books and music and a statue of Bonaparte, which I would have thought would be a bit sort of radical, wouldn't it, for 1818?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, don't get me started on the Bonaparte obsession, because that was also an obsession of Keats's great friend William Hazlitt. A lot of people still had their little statues of Bonaparte even after Waterloo. But yeah, I mean, there's something about the stylishness of her room, together with the stylishness of these letters, which are full of literary and theatrical references, the letters she writes to Keats's publisher. Now, of course, the problem is that because actresses were known as Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jordan, and so on, unless they became very well known or unless other records survive, it's actually very difficult to find out their first names. So I cannot prove that my Mrs. Jones, the actress and singer, was Keats's Mrs. Jones, because I haven't found the silver bullet, the bit of evidence of her first name. If we actually found her name was not Isabella, we know Keats's Mrs. Jones was Isabella because of the references in the letters to his publisher, then this is yet another dead end, yet another red herring, like the one that all the previous biographers have found. The infuriating thing about the COVID lockdown is that I can't get to the archive of the Theatre Royal at Cheltenham, where she made her debut, because if there's evidence anywhere of the first name of my Cheltenham singer who was brought to London, it would be there. So my piece that I've written, which I've sort of grown from, spun off from my recent book, in this week's TLS, it ends by saying, you know, this is a gamble, it's a speculation, and if some learned TLS reader discovers that actually my Mrs. Jones, who performed on the stage with the great Edmund Kean, the greatest actor of the age, who Keats was obsessed with, if she wasn't Isabella, then I'm afraid I've led you all up the garden path. But who cares? Because it's such a wonderful letter where he describes her room.
What a tantalising sense of to be continued. I wonder if behind this story, you know, partial as it is, there's a sadness here as well. When Fanny arrives on the scene, Mrs. Jones pretty much disappears from Keats's paint box, doesn't she? Or is that sadness a projection, do you think? I might say it suggests a certain expendability. You mentioned the precarity of the actor's life, but she might say it cuts both ways and she was free and didn't want to be Keats's Mrs.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. What I really like about Mrs. Jones is the fact that when she's down in Hastings, and who knows, maybe she's doing a performance down there, she's very happy to have a bit of a kiss and a fondle with Keats. Back in London, she takes him up to her room and she shows him the room and enjoys talking to him. But when he makes a pass at her, she says no thanks. This is a woman who's in control of her body, in control of her destiny, in control of her independence. And I think there is a certain wistfulness in the way Keats writes about her. In some ways, did he actually fall in love with Fanny Brawne on the rebound? Because it's only a few weeks later that he begins to get to know Fanny. He spends Christmas that year with the Brawne family. And Fanny, you know, she's a lively enough girl, but she's not quite in the league of Mrs. Jones.
It's also a very romantic story, isn't it? First they meet at the seaside and then he just walks past her in London and then decides to turn around. And I mean, it's almost rom-com, isn't it?
Absolutely right. Yeah. And again, I mean, the other nice thing was he did actually say there was one other time before that meeting in the streets where he met her. And where was it? When he was at the Lyceum Theatre. So there's no doubt that she's kind of moving in that theatre world.
So, I mean, you mentioned the lockdown stopping you getting to the archive that you wanted to. Do you feel you are done with the story of Mrs. Jones now? Or, I mean, you know, the idea of her as this professional pretender, perhaps, it's the ultimate taunt or challenge to biographers still, surely?
Oh, absolutely it is. And I shall not rest or cease from mental fight and archival exploration until I find out whether she is or is not my actress come singer.
Well, Jonathan Bate, many thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Alan Rusbridger and Jonathan Bate. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson, a weekly series of in-depth interviews with high-profile figures examining how overcoming the challenges of their early lives shaped the people they've become. This week, Bake Off winner, TV chef and author Nadia Hussein reveals the violent racial abuse she suffered as a British Bangladeshi in 1980s Luton, her struggles with mental health, and how baking has changed her life.
Racism and that kind of unconscious bias exists in every industry. And so now that I'm in them, I see the problem with them is that there is nobody else.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson. Nadia Hussein, in her own words. Now available as a podcast. Listen on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.